The following podcast contains coarse language, adult themes, and major plot spoilers. Listener discretion is advised.
Of Podcasters of Horror, and for this series, well, for this mini series, we are discussing the unfortunately short-lived series Masters of Horror. So there's our little podcast name. I am your trusty host, Super Marcy, and with me, as always, is my trusty co-host, the terrible Australian Bede Jemine. Hello, Bede.
Hello, Marcy. How are you?
I am doing well, and how are you?
Oh, not too bad, thanks. Just getting all prepared for the Halloween season, which will, or at least around the time this episode is online, we're probably already neck deep into it, because I know I've got, I've just posted my 31 days of horror viewing list, and I have tons of movies, I like tons of horror films I'm going to be watching on it, so I'm really excited that what this season's going to bring, because it's always this time of the year that I always find a lot of fun, Marcy.
Yes, well, October is going to be a very busy month. My birthday is in October, 2 days before Halloween, so there's that. And we also, you'll be at Monsterfest, which is in October this year, and hopefully I'll be able to join you for some screenings, and definitely very excited to check out Rabid. That's probably the one I'm looking forward to the most.
Marcy, I thought Colour Out of Space with Nicolas Cage would be the most anticipated.
Well, that too, of course. Can't beat the Nicolas Cage.
Yes.
But yes, as busy as we'll be for October, I think the special guest we have on is probably even more so excited for October. So yes, Podcasters of Horror is branching out to have a guest. So I'd like to welcome Matt Konopka from Killer Horror Critic. Hello.
Hello. Hello. Thanks for having me on as your trusty guest today. And Marcy, I think I missed before. Happy birthday, or early birthday, I mean.
Yeah, about a month early, where I'm turning 21 again.
Awesome. It's a good age. Good age to turn again.
Yeah.
I'm obviously very excited for October as well, as I will be getting married on October 31st.
You couldn't have picked a better wedding date.
I don't think there is a better day on the calendar,
no,
personally.
Not at all.
I mean, how often do you get to have a horror-themed wedding, am I right?
Yeah, it's not something that happens every day.
No. I'm pretty sure my parents and her parents are not thrilled that it's that it's something that doesn't happen every day, but
I'm sure they'll be so pleased when, like, Michael Myers shows up to your wedding.
Oh, totally. Yeah, no, I invited him, Freddy, Leatherface, you know, the whole gang.
Matt, I'm gonna be very disappointed if Freddy Krueger isn't officiating your wedding.
I'm gonna be too, man. You know, I reached out to him. I was like, Robert, we're best friends. You owe me this one. just come on over, speak for 10 minutes. You know, no big deal. I'll fly you out.
Well, if Marcy and I know anything about Robert Englund, if you ask him to talk about anything, he might at least go for about an hour or two. Just say.
Yeah, you know, it's the thing that I love about Robert, but also like, mildly disgruntled over, just because I tried to meet him at Monsterpalooza a year ago and wasn't able to because the line was about like 5 or 6 hours long. But no, that's the great thing about Robert, is I feel like the line takes a while because he likes to chat with everyone. You know, he's not just some asshole who's like, the fuck is your name? All right, here.
Yeah.
Here you go.
No, he's very nice. He's very engaging. And when Bede and I met him several years ago, I think I held up the line for like 10, 15 minutes talking about Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge, because I'm sure no one else asked him about that movie, and he seemed really interested to be discussing it, so it's very cool.
I mean, that's awesome of him, and I can't blame him Nightmare on Elm Street 2 is a pretty interesting film. I kind of dig it.
It's probably one of my like all-time favorite movies. I absolutely love it to pieces. And yeah, I think every time we watch it, Bede, we just find something new in that movie, and it's like crazy. There's like more subtext.
Yeah. Indeed. Like, I remember when we watched the Blu-ray of it for the first time, and I noticed like in the, I think it was either on the bed or on the window, there's like these little carvings of like of love hearts on the window. And I'm like, okay, I've never noticed that before.
It's amazing.
But my favorite thing of all time, of course, when you see the game Probe in Jesse's closet. It's a film that has a lot of, it's meant to be subtext, but it's clearly overtext when you watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just love the, in the conversations I've seen with the filmmakers, you know, they always seem to come off like, we did not intend to make the movie that you've all made it out to be. but it's like you look at it and you're like, well, okay, well, if that's the case, what a happy accident, because I love what they did.
It is quite possibly the most amazing movie ever made. Just saying.
Mm-hmm.
And, you might be right. Yeah, that'll totally segue to our topic of conversation for this evening. So where we're up to with Masters of Horror is we'll be discussing episode or short movie number 7, Dear Woman from John Landis, and episode 8, Cigarette Burns from John Carpenter. So on our debut episode for the show, Bede and I discussed how we first got introduced to Masters of Horror, whether we watched it when it first came out or discovered it a bit later. So what was your experience in first seeing Masters of Horror?
Yeah, so, I mean, my overall experience with it was just that, you know, I loved it. I did watch this show as it was coming out and releasing. I think it was a weekly show, if I remember right. Pretty sure I heard about it through maybe Fangoria. I think I might have read about it there that it was coming out. But anyway, regardless, I just thought it was an amazing show because, you know, to me, I consider this the probably greatest collection of horror talent to ever come together for a collaboration. Mm. I mean, you have K&B doing all the effects for each film, if I remember right. And then you have all these, you know, masters of horror, John Carpenter, John Landis, all these guys working on it. And I just think that, you know, what was so wonderful about it is Mick Garris was able to bring all these people together. And I think it's because, you know, if I remember right, the sort of pitch that he had for them was that, you know, this is going to be on Showtime, but you guys are going to get to have the freedom to do whatever you want. You know, no big studio restrictions telling you got to cut this and cut that, or, you know, take this gore out here and, you know, replace it with a love story here. Like, they got to do whatever they wanted. And I think that was a big draw for them because it kind of, you know, resulted in Masters of Horror being a little bit of a sandbox, you know, all these Masters of Horror playing the sandbox of film. And yeah, it's just a really fun result. I was devastated when they canceled it after 2 seasons.
Yeah, it's a shame it didn't last much, like, longer than 2 seasons, because there's just so much great stuff in there, so much talent in there, and it was a really great concept. But maybe the world just wasn't ready for Masters of Horror. I don't know.
I think that's very possible. I wonder what would have happened with it had it come out today, because, you know, this was in, what, 2005, so around that time, I mean, we didn't really have streaming services or anything like that. And, you know, so a big problem for it was, and you also didn't have the mass amount of love for horror that we do now. You know, back then when I think I was in high school still, it was still kind of this thing of like, it's getting a little more popular, but for the most part, you're still a fucking weirdo if you love horror.
Yeah.
and now, now the public's kind of embraced it a bit more. So I think it would have more of an audience. And I think that the streaming service would definitely help because, you know, I mean, not many of us are able to, you know, sit down at a scheduled time every week for a show. We just don't really do that much anymore. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, especially now, because in the past 10 years, horror anthologies have made a comeback, not just on TV, but also in film as well. Like, some of them, Marcy and I have talked about, you know, have taken a different approach, like American Horror Story, instead of doing like one story per episode, they just have one story stretched out each season and do a different one, like each season after that. But now they're sort of going back to that sort of format of doing one story per episode, like the new Twilight Zone, which is done that. And of course, Shudder's got Creepshow coming up, which is going back to that sort of one story per episode kind of format. Yeah. And
it's there's others, by the way.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, we won't be able to see it because we still don't have Shudder in Australia yet, but I digress.
Sorry for you guys.
But, yeah, I know. But there are other ones in the works as well. I know Guillermo del Toro's got a horror anthology series that he's producing for Netflix coming up, I think, next year, I think. So, like, this is a good time. And, of course, you know, the last few years I've had a few anthology horror films. And funnily enough, Mick Garris was involved with an anthology film that came out recently, Nightmare Cinema, that kind of goes back to that sort of Masters of Horror mold, but in a movie form.
Yeah, I was actually going to mention Nightmare Cinema because I don't know about you guys, but I personally really enjoyed that one too. And I sort of get the impression, and you know, obviously I don't have proof of this, but I sort of get the impression that that was kind of Mick Garris's pitch for like, hey, let me bring something like Masters of Horror back again. Because you're right, it is the perfect time for a show like this to be running. And I mean, there are services like Shudder who I think would pick it up in a heartbeat if they were able to. I get the impression from Mick, like, to me, this is what Mick does best is these collaborations and, you know, bringing talent together and finding ways for them to get this stuff out to us. I think he's perfect at it. So I would love if that ended up being the case, but I digress.
Yeah. I guess we'll see what happens. Bea, do you want to take us through our first episode for discussion, Dear Woman?
Maybe a car crash.
No, I don't think so. It looks like somebody broke the door off from the inside.
What the hell could do that?
Look, the door ain't the problem. Problem's inside.
No one on staff would look at him for more than a couple seconds.
There's a chance this is an animal attack.
Really?
Just look.
Hoofprints.
What more can you tell me about this woman?
She was just real sexy, you know?
You don't fool around, do you? This is definitely my lucky day.
Whatever's happened to these men, it's happened because of her.
I found this under his fingernails.
That can't be human hair.
Yeah, it's deer hair.
For an animal of that size and strength to be hiding in a major metropolitan area is frankly impossible.
Have you seen the bodies? You think a human did that?
Maybe the girl beat him to death with a deer leg. What's wrong?
That's just one of those sentences that you never expect to hear.
This has happened here before. Okay, about 100 years ago, 11 loggers were found pulverized. They'd all been seen with a pretty woman.
I got a girl in here, man. I will call you tomorrow.
Have you seen her feet?
Say what?
Do you know her? Have you seen her feet?
Reed.
Indeed. Dear Woman, of course, was directed by John Landis, who, of course, the director behind the films American Werewolf in London, Innocent Blood, and as well as comedies like The Blues Brothers. The episode was written by John Landis and his son, Max Landis, and the film stars Brian Benben, just getting the list up who else was starring, Anthony Griffith, Sonia Bennett, Cynthia Mora. And the plot summary for this one is: in this horror comedy, a police detective investigates a series of brutal murders which are committed by an ancient creature from Native American mythology. And Marcy, what did you think of... actually, Matt, what did you think
of...
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, I was just thinking...
Just skip right over you, Marcy.
I apologize, Marcy. I know you have a lot to say about this one, but I remember we usually ask our guests first.
We do.
So I figured, well, I'll backtrack and let Matt explain his thoughts on D1.
All right. Well, I should preface with, I'm going to do my best to withhold my disdain for the scum of the earth that is Max Landis and his father. So,
Well, that's kind of like the big elephant in the room that we'll have to at least talk about a bit, especially in highlight in the past couple of months that allegations of sexual assault, misconduct have happened with Max Landis. And from what I've heard, even before all that stuff came out, I've heard that he, from a lot of people, that he in person is a major, major douchebag.
Oh, yes.
So a talented one, because he has written some movies that I've actually quite like Chronicle and American Ultra, which I thought are both great movies. But
for sure.
Yeah, but that doesn't change the fact that as talented as a writer he can be, doesn't change his behavior. But Matt, continue.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just, and yes, it's absolutely true. Everyone I've ever spoken to who's met him just absolutely hates the guy for all the reasons we can probably imagine. He basically sounds like a pretentious douche, which, you know, I get it, I guess. Not really. But, okay, as far as Dear Woman goes, I actually, again, taking my feelings out of it, I actually do really enjoy this one for the most part. I thought that of the first season, it was one of the funnier episodes. You know, you can definitely tell that John Landis had a hand in this. I mean, it's a hysterical film. It's very stupid, you know. It's not exactly the most brilliant premise, but I think that they find a way to play with that. You know, I really enjoy the scene where Detective Dwight is trying to think up in his head of what's going on with these killings. And he imagines all these different scenarios that go from, you know, a woman actually beating someone to death with a deer leg to this like giant buff deer Frankenstein-esque creature, like carrying her around into the forest. And, you know, so they do really fun stuff with it. I think the character of Dwight is great. And that's, you know, that's a credit that I regretfully give Max, is that he does a great job in giving us a character that's entertaining to watch. You know, I never really cared too much about Dwight's backstory, but he's a fun guy to watch. You know, I love the scene where he's mugged by an attacker and, you know, ends up getting the guy on the ground and then just stabbing him for no reason. Just be like, you know what? Fuck you for ruining my day. Like,
yeah.
So I mean, overall, it's just a really fun film that, you know, I'm not going to walk away thinking too heavily about, but it's an entertaining movie. So I have to give it that, as much as I don't like either of these guys.
Which is fair.
Yeah.
Beat, am I allowed to speak now?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I apologize before, Marcy.
Okay, but well,
go right ahead.
All right, so obviously, yeah, I'm with Matt on fuck those two douchebags. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't until more last few years that I sort of had read more and seen more of, like, John Landis and his own behavior and stuff. And then pretty much since Max Landis kind of made a name for himself with writing, I'd been hearing just horror stories about him being a douchebag, a prick. And then, of course, now, you know, accusations of sexual assault and whatnot. So, yeah, got no love for this father and son duo. And look, I prefer to sort of separate art from artist, I guess, from the person. But I kind of found that really difficult with this film, because I just felt like there was things that were very misogynistic about it, and
yes,
elements that I'm like, you really freaking hate women. So that kind of, like, I had messaged Bede when I watched it, because I can't remember if I watched it originally or not. Yeah, I have very mixed feelings on it, because on the one side, like, there are a lot of entertaining elements. Some of it's quite well written. With you, that the main detective is an interesting character and he plays it really, really well. I like that the sort of central mystery is, like, it is ridiculous, and you sort of deal with these very sort of straight-laced characters trying to deal with something that's seems very ridiculous, which I think worked. But I think on that other side, it's like, this movie does not like women, and that does not sit well with me. So,
well, don't worry, Marcy. We can talk a lot about how I think this movie reflects this reflects Max Landis's insecurity with women.
Absolutely, it does. Like, I have nothing wrong with, say, a female sort of, I guess, villainish type thing. But I think just the way it's handled is very just not done in the best way. I don't mind how it kind of goes back to like a Native American mythological being and whatnot, like that's okay. But yeah, there was just there's good things and bad things, and it's just it's so hard to enjoy the movie when there's just these things that are sticking out at me, like
right.
But
so,
you know, I was gonna say, like, what John Landis does well is sort of mixing horror and comedy. And like you said, it is very funny. There are some very funny scenes, which do work. But again, it just becomes very difficult with this movie.
Just so I understand too, so Marcy, this was your first time seeing it recently, right?
Yeah, from what I can remember, because I can't actually remember if I watched it originally or not. So it's like, if I did, I don't remember it. So it is like watching it for the first time?
Oh, I just asked because, you know, I figured we'd probably end up talking about it a bit, so I hadn't mentioned yet. But I will say that, you know, originally when I first saw it, again, I thought it was really entertaining and funny and, you know, had its problems. But as I was rewatching it this time, I still find, like you said, parts of it enjoyable. But there are a lot of things having to do with sort of the sexism and the misogyny of it that really rubbed me the wrong way, especially kind of knowing more about who these guys are now.
Yeah, it sort of brings to light a lot more than it should.
Yeah.
Or was ever intended to. But yeah, no, it was sort of a very mixed bag for me.
Yeah, like I have a big problem with how the woman sort of goes about her killing, but I'm sure we'll talk about that after he tells us what he thinks.
Yes, Bede, what did you think?
Indeed. I'm kind of somewhat in the same boat as you, but I probably liked it a little bit more. Like, I get sort of, at the time, I think my feelings on it now are pretty much the same as it was when it first came out. I think on its own, it's a pretty solid and enjoyable episode, and it is quite funny. But there's kind of an awkwardness to it, and I think in the way how some scenes, either on both sort of on a script level and a direction level, just come across as a bit awkward and a bit sort of sluggish. But when the movie actually does shine, it shines really well. And I think, and I can definitely, sort of watching it now, given everything that has been going on with Max Landis, I can definitely sort of see that undercurrent of, you know, sexism and misogyny in there, especially with how it sort of portrays the dear woman, especially because she doesn't talk at all throughout the whole film and just is there to kind of lure, even though it is based on Native American legend where she just lures promiscuous men and then kills them. But it's just how it's sort of handled does come across as very awkward.
It's just like, okay, so women are there to look pretty, and then they will just destroy you. It's like, no, dude, you fuck off, basically.
Yeah. But I think when the film does actually work really well is just the other stuff around that, those kind of sections. Like, for example, like the characters are really well done. I think Brian Benben, who plays Detective Dwight Faraday, I think was excellent in this episode. And I just, I haven't seen the TV show that he's probably best known for, Dream On, but I was introduced to him in this episode as an actor, and I just really loved his performance. And he's just got this sort of dry, sarcastic wit about him. And he's got a really interesting sort of, as a character, he's really interesting and has an interesting backstory as well, which you sort of find out more, like why he's sort of mocked in the police force and why he's sort of put in this box where he has to sort of look at, like, his cases instead of, like, being homicides, he is now sort of working on animal attacks.
Yeah, he gets the weird ones.
The weird ones, as he said, the weird calls, as he says a lot. But I think he was really great in the episode. Some of the acting outside of him is kind of a bit of a mixed bag. Like Anthony Griffith, who plays his partner, Officer Jacob Reed, I feel like he's kind of was on and off throughout the whole episode. Like sometimes
he's on and off.
Like sometimes he comes across as very wooden as well. But it is really funny when there's some great dialogue that is just, every time I hear it, just makes me laugh out loud. And there's some really sort of great little sequences. And it's funny though, there's a jump scare in the movie, like at the very beginning, that no matter how many times I see this episode, it always fucking gets me. And even though I see it coming all the time, it always makes me jump every time it happens. And also like that at least the episode acknowledges how kind of dumb its premise is as well, because even the characters are like, this is just ridiculous. So I give the film credit for that. And also I do love the sort of the fact that this episode is set in the same universe as an American Werewolf in London.
Yeah, there was a very not subtle reference to that.
Oh, not subtle at all.
No.
Yeah. But I did enjoy that it's kind of set in that same world as well. And also, like, even though we've sort of been talking about sort of how this episode sort of treats women, there is one female character in the film who's kind of the more prominent one next to the Deer Woman, and that is a mortician character named Dana, played by Sonya Bennett, who I think outside of Brian Benbeng is the second best performance in the episode, because I just loved her character and I just think that she's really funny and there's just something of quality about her that she steals every scene that she is
I agree, she's great
and I like the score and this is definitely kind of not one of my favorite episodes of Masters of Horror. Like it's an overly decent one, but it's definitely got some flaws on both a script level and direction level that kind of sort of stop it from being truly great, at least in my eyes anyway.
I think I can agree on that. But I think just look, if they sort of wrote something that didn't hate women, perhaps it would have been somewhat better. But it's definitely not one of my favorites in Masters of Horror.
So I'm curious what you guys think about this. So I think one of the things that really bugs me about it is, you know, touching on the way that it treats women, something that I really despise in horror when it does this is like I hope, you know, some of your listeners will probably be mad at me for this, but take Last House on the Left, for example. Something that's always bugged me about that film is that, you know, in the end, once the parents are getting vengeance for what happened to their daughter, the mother still goes as far as to blow one of the guys before she kills him. And, you know, to me, I never really understood why that's even necessary. You know, it feels like they're trying to, it just feels like they're missing the point, you know, of what's going on in that film. And so I get the same impression here where, okay, so we're supposed to believe that the Deer Woman is luring men away to murder them, and that's fine. I'm okay with that. It's just, does she really have to fuck them first too before doing this? Like, that's...
Apparently she has to show her boobs, at least.
Right, well, you definitely have to show the boobs.
Yeah, apparently it's just like, yeah, she has to show her boobs.
But, you know, example is the guy is the first kill in the hotel room, I believe, where I'm pretty sure the implication there is she gets down to blow the guy and then kills him later. And I guess for me, it's just like, is there a point to this, or are we just trying to over-sexualize this, which I think kind of, you know, plays into the whole misogyny of it, if that's the case.
Look, I think so. It's almost like, I don't know how to explain it. It's just like, you know, it's trying to, in a way, say, you know, women are just there for use,
right,
and then they will destroy a man. It's like, well, go fuck yourself, basically.
Right. Yeah, it's... Yeah, I do think it's hard. It's really hard to, like, I think I would have this feeling no matter what with this film, but it's especially hard when once you apply Max to this. And
yeah, just, it is.
You know, put yourself in the mindset of that guy writing this. Like,
yeah.
And like I mentioned earlier, you know, I do feel that there's a bit of, you know, because all of us writers, we put a little bit of ourselves into our work. And I definitely get a sense that this film's almost kind of an expression of, and maybe this is just me hating on him, but almost kind of an expression of, you know, Max Landis's own fear or distrust.
Yeah,
of women.
No, I agree completely.
Yeah, because, I mean, not only is the whole thing about, you know, this pretty quiet girl who's essentially treated like an object the entire time, not only is it about her being, you know, deadly and all that, but there's just all these lines like, you know, I think there's a mention about a penis that snapped in half or something. And, you know, I just take those things as, like, Max's own insecurity of not trusting women, like they're gonna destroy him somehow.
Yeah, it feels like that. And, well, basically they have, because he treated them like shit. So
yeah, I'm just a side note, can I mention how hilarious it was? I mean, not hilarious because we were all pissed, but how hilarious it was when it was announced that Max was going to be doing this, like, all female war story or something like that. Like, he was going to be adapting some film that was supposed to be all about female empowerment, and every one of us were just like, can you just go ahead and fuck off again? Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, like, just piss off. Anyway.
Yeah.
Bede, what do you rate the film out of 5?
You know what, I'm going to give it a 3 out of 5. Like I said, there are things about it that I still find enjoyable, but it is kind of like, there is, like I said, an awkwardness to it as well, and on both a filmmaking and writing level. But I still enjoy it nonetheless. But I think mainly for some certain sequences that I think are both really well done and clever. Like, there's a scene in the film that is a clear homage to the original Cat People film, which I really enjoyed. And like, it is, like I said, it is quite funny. It has some really strong performances, but it's not one of my favorites. But for me personally, John Landis would do a much better job as a filmmaker for Masters of Horror with his season 2 episode, which we'll talk about in a future episode.
And Matt, what would your rating be out of 5?
Yeah, I'd probably give it a, I'd say I'd give it a 3 as well, because it, you know, the points I'm taking off are specifically just because I really don't like a lot of the messaging and the treatment of women in this. But aside from that, it is entertaining. I do really love the character of Dwight. I agree with Bede that I do sense an awkwardness in this film. It's kind of like, to me, it almost feels like Landis sort of phoned it in a bit at times. You know, it really is hard to put your finger on it. It feels like, it almost feels like he just kind of got there and was like, all right, let's just get this fucking over with. And, but, you know, again, the talented writing and sense of humor of Landis and his son does come out, and it is funny. So I would have to give it a 3 out of 5, but it's also not nearly one of my more favorite episodes of the season.
My rating would be 2 out of 5, and I know that sounds harsh.
No, I don't think so.
But I just can't ignore what's in there, and the 2 it gets are just for the bits that I think are well done. So, yeah, 2 out of 5 from me. All right.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
Yep. Okay, moving on, we will discuss, which out of all the episodes I have actually seen, and there's still some I haven't, this one remains my favorite, and possibly one of my just favorite movies, because it is, really, it is a short movie, John Carpenter's Cigarette Burns.
The fin absolute du monde, the absolute end of the world. The government seized it and destroyed it.
I'm a bit obsessive. I want you to find a brand for me.
We are a part of the film. If it had been destroyed, we would know.
Bakovic said film in the right hands is a weapon.
Wait, you spoke to Bakovic?
At the start of the festival. I recorded the whole interview. These will change your life.
Last night I saw something I can't...
A circle? Huh? Like the real change in the movie?
Yeah.
Then it started. It's only going to get worse from here.
What started? What's happening to me?
Are you my sweet man, Kirby?
As soon as you start getting close to it...
It gets inside you.
Tell me where the film is.
That's not what you want to know. You want to know if the stories about the film are true.
I know what you want. You want to see the movie.
Relax.
Something happens when you point the camera at something terrible. The resulting film takes on power.
This one was obviously directed by John Carpenter, written by Drew McQueenie and Rebecca Swan, starring Norman Reedus and Udo Kier, and they're the two that I want to mention because they're awesome. And the plot summary, which I'm taking from IMDb, with a torrid past that haunts him, a movie theater owner is hired to search for the only existing print of a film so notorious that its single screening caused the viewers to become homicidally insane. So the legendary horror movie is called La Fin Absolue du Monde, so a nice French title. And yeah, so Bede, no, sorry, Matt. Just pull a bead.
Very nice.
Matt, please share your thoughts on the glory that is cigarette burns.
Yeah, so I'm with you. I think this is one of the best episodes of both seasons. It's John Carpenter, who is my hero in terms of directors. I love his work, and I think you can see a lot of why in this film. I mean, overall, I think what's so great about Cigarette Burns is it's just a really fascinating film that taps into, I think the way a lot of us kind of look at film, it really taps into what is special about it and what is powerful about it. And you know, like Carpenter, he likes to kind of play around with these themes of media and how it affects the public, like he did it with They Live and In the Mouth of Madness, which is one of my favorites. And he does it again here with Cigarette Burns, where I mean, this whole story is about the power of a single short film and how it, you know, affects everybody at this screening and drives them to madness. And I just think it's very relatable for, you know, big film nuts like us, because, you know, I think we can probably all say that we have that that white whale of a film that we've always tried to seek out, and we want to experience it. You know, like, I love that, you know, Norman Reese's character, he doesn't necessarily want to own the film. He just wants to see it. You know, he's doing all of this mostly for the money, but also he really just wants to experience this movie. And that's what everyone around him is doing, is they can't help but want to lay their eyes on it, because, you know, that's how a lot of us get with this sort of stuff. You know, if there's something we haven't seen that we know is supposed to be special, we want to see it no matter what. You know, even if, like, I think even if someone was telling me, Matt, you don't want to see this horror film because it'll drive you to madness, I'd probably still be like, well, now I just want to see it more. So I really love it. I think that Reedus and especially Udo Kier give great performances. I love the sort of darkness of the film. You know, it's a very dark Carpenter story. The effects are grisly and they affect you. And, you know, there's a real power to it that I think just really kind of digs in deep. And yeah, it's, I don't know. How do you guys feel about it? I overall just really, really love this one.
Okay. I guess I'll go. Okay. For me, what's interesting about Cigarette Burns, because, you know, like how I think you and I talked about this, Marcy, because we've been doing this series, like, in a release order of the episodes in the US. But the interesting thing is when Masters of Horror premiered in Australia, they did it out of order and Cigarette Burns was the very first episode they saw. So they pretty much kicked it off with a bang when they released it here from the very start. And Cigarette Burns, having rewatched it, I've seen this one quite a number of times, and it definitely is up there as one of Carpenter's best works. And for me, this is one like that does feel like his work, like his cinematic work. And like you said, Matt, you could easily see this one put aside along, you know, some of his films like In the Mouth of Madness, which is the one that kind of reminded me the most of while watching this film, just without sort of that sort of H.P. Lovecraft quality. And I think the performances are great. Norman Reedus is really good, but Udo Kier is probably, for me, the standout of it as well. But also, I just, you know, as somebody who loves films, but also movies that are about films, this one was totally going to be my jam. And it's interesting because a couple episodes back, Marcy, we talked about Dario Argento's episode, Jennifer, how we sort of talked about how that felt so, didn't feel like an Argento film. But watching this one feels more like an Argento film than Jennifer does. And because I think European horror was definitely a major influence in how Carpenter approached this story, not just because, you know, you had Norman Reedus's character going around country to country trying to find this film, but just sort of the tone and feel of it as well, and the sort of the darkness that Carpenter taps into with the story. Like, there's one section of the film where Reedus, while trying to look for the film and try to get information, he stumbles across basically a snuff film ring as well, and it almost becomes part of it as well, which is a very dark and disturbing scene and how that's sort of done. And I mean, from beginning to end, it's just really compelling. Like, Norman Reedus's character has a sort of a complex backstory because he has a tragic past in which his girlfriend, because before the events of this story, they were both drug addicts, and then she kills herself, and then he has to kind of has to live with the repercussions of that. But he's cleaned himself up and is running the cinema that they were gonna own together. But of course, he's being harassed by her rich father who basically wants to see him dead. And like, from beginning to end, this film is just really captivating. It has a lot of weird imagery and it's really grisly in how it showcases its gore and violence. And of course, it's just one of those ones where, like, after you watch Cigarette Burns, you just don't forget about it after you watch it. And and as we've stated before, like we always talk about, like, is any of, when we talk about a specific episode, like, is this one good enough to be fleshed out into a full feature-length film? And this one, for me, definitely would make a great
100%
film. Definitely.
Like, you want more of this. And look, I could probably spend a whole day just talking about this hour of film, but this one, just when I first saw it, it stuck with me for such a long time. I think it's the imagery, the story, just everything is just so incredible. It's just so well done. And yeah, I'm with you guys as well that it is, it's kind of a companion piece to In the Mouth of Madness, because they do have a lot of similarities, which, you know, that's, In the Mouth of Madness is also one of my favorites. But I think there's just something so haunting about this film. And, you know, from the get-go, when you see, like the angel that's kind of in chains in the Udo Kier's character's house, like, you know you're not in for something that's going to be straightforward. And, you know, you start wondering, like, what the hell is this lost movie that drove people mad? With such an interesting title and... it's just really intriguing, and, you know, not everything is really explained either, which I think works as well.
Yeah, it's always better, I think, the less we know with horror, because I always like to imagine, like, what's worse. You know, what you imagine is always worse than what you're going to see on screen, which, you know, to touch on the film that ultimately, you know, is the centerpiece of this movie, I want to add that I think it's really smart of Carpenter to have not really shown any of that film in this. Because again, we're being told that this is a film that, you know, was so horrific and mind-blowing that it drove people to madness. And if he actually showed us that film,
it takes away the effect, I think.
Exactly. It takes away the effect, and there's no way that it could ever live up to expectations. And I always thought that The Ring was a good example of that, where, you know, the video itself is like, okay, it's kind of creepy, but the idea of the video is much scarier than what you actually see on screen.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you mentioned the angel too, because something that I think, again, is really powerful about this movie is that, you know, Norman Reedus's character Kirby, he sees this angel, which, I mean, he doesn't know it's an angel at the time, but he sees this man essentially chained up on this little platform that's slowly spinning in a circle in Udo Kier's house, and he really doesn't seem to have a second thought about it.
Yeah, that's something I noticed. It's like, wouldn't you be putting two and two together? He's got the wings in the other room, and you can clearly see they've been cut off this man. It's like, wouldn't you do something or feel something? Or is it the power of just the thought of this movie that intense that you don't think these things?
And that's what I think it is that I love so much about this. You know, again, this is a film that I think really speaks to, you know, again, film nerds like us, because it's all about that power of wanting to see this film. You know, Kirby is so attracted to the idea of seeing this film that drove people insane that he is willing to overlook essentially a captured angel with its wings cut off in some guy's house.
Yeah,
you know,
pretty much.
It's just like a side note to him. Like, he does not care. He only cares about the film.
Yeah, and I really like how it's really well paced. Everything's kind of revealed in certain ways, and like, you can kind of muster together that the guy that directed the infamous movie obviously did some kind of deal with the devil, which I think adds a bit more intrigue, but it's not really outright said, but you can pick up the pieces, and I like that, which makes the idea of this film much more horrific, and that, you know, it was made to maybe unleash like a hell on earth, and that's why it's not really been seen, and when they do see it, you see the horrific aftermath of it.
Right.
Which, of course, you know, spoiler alert, ends with a bit of murder and suicide.
Yeah, some pretty grisly shit. You know, something that, there's a moment in this film that I really, really appreciate where I forget which character is saying this. It's one of the guys that Kirby goes to visit. But they talk about this idea of, I think it's the reviewer he goes to meet, but he talks about this idea of when you go and see a film, you're essentially putting your trust into the filmmaker, right? And you trust that you're going to sit down and you're going to experience something, but it's not going to be something that's so psychologically damaging that I'm suddenly going to jump out of my seat and murder everyone. And, you know, I think that just really taps into, you know, something kind of primal and fearful in us, in that, you know, you are putting your trust into these filmmakers. And if someone were to, like you mentioned, Marcy, make a deal with the devil and, you know, come up with this film that they could show everyone. I mean, I don't know. I just love that idea of someone having the power to do that with an image, because this stuff is more powerful than we give it credit for. I mean, you look at film festivals where you hear stories of people that have, you know, vomited during the movie, or, you know, run out screaming or something. And it might not affect us like that, but it does have that effect on some people.
Yeah, it's like when we were at the Melbourne International Film Festival last week, when we went and saw The Nightingale, like, there were people who walked out of that film. Like,
yeah,
that's how cinema can just be so powerful that it can get that kind of reaction. Maybe not, or, you know, sort of some, we all react differently in a lot of ways, but but I think what, like you sort of said about also The Ring as well, which is which also was another thing that reminded me a lot of this film while I was watching it, because it does
besides, there's I said things there, yeah.
Yeah, like, even though it has, it feels like a Euro horror film, but there definitely does have that sort of quality of Japanese horror cinema in there as well.
Right.
Especially you have this kind of item, you know, use it like, and this is what Japanese horror films did a lot in the sort of late 90s, early 2000s, is use technology to have sort of something horror, I mean, demonic about it, like whether it's a videotape or a computer or a phone, or, you know, it's kind of using those as these kind of vessels for something much more horrifying. And the fact that it's this one film, or at least a reel of film, that can make anyone who watches it just go mad. And I, in a lot of ways, I could also, it just, in that regard, it just works really well. And you know, when we were sort of talking about, you know, talking about In the Mouth of Madness and that, because I know Carpenter has said that The Thing, Prince of Darkness, and In the Mouth of Madness are his, like, unofficial apocalyptic trilogy. Mm. And for me, Cigarette Burns could almost be like the epilogue to those ones.
Yeah,
even though it's a much more small, like, it's a much more smaller scale compared to those ones. But since, well, the film at the center of the story has its English translation is the absolute end of the world, like, it could almost be seen as a film that could literally bring the apocalypse.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I was kind of thinking about that same thing yesterday. So very nice point made.
And also, let's not forget the score, which was done by John Carpenter's son, Cody Carpenter.
Yeah,
which,
I think it's really good. I think that was his first.
Yeah, that was his first, yeah. And right. Like, his score reminded me, like, even though I've always liked this score, but on this recent rewatch, I just realized it sounds almost so much like either the Suspiria score or even the Exorcist score. And there's like this simple kind of piano tune that just keeps going over and over again. And it's just really beautifully done. And of course,
yeah,
you know, Cody Carpenter will do a lot more scoring later on, and even work with his dad on doing the score for the Halloween film that came out last year.
Yeah, and I mean, that score was one of the highlights of the new Halloween film for me. It clearly, musical talent runs in the family, because both Cody and John are just extremely talented when it comes to that.
Absolutely. Yeah, look, I don't know if there's, like I said, I could just go on and on about it, but I don't want to be here for like 50 hours talking about this movie. I just think it's brilliant. There's so much I love about it. And look, as much as I love that we don't really see images of that film, I just want to see that film.
Right. Well, I mean, again, like, I think that's the brilliance of it, though, right?
Yeah.
Like, even knowing how this film goes, I think all three of us can say if something like this existed in the world, where it's like, hey, there's this obscure film that a handful of people have seen and it drove them mad.
We'd be like, yeah, I want to see that.
Yeah, all three of us would be like, oh, it drove them mad? Awesome, I want to see that.
Yeah. But on a side note, the kind of central story about seeing this film and the repercussions of it, Tobe Hooper actually wrote a book, a fictional book, where he is actually, like, a character in the story, where one of his very early, like, short movies, I think, gets found and screened. But the movie has, like, once it's seen, it has these strange, like, repercussions. So it kind of has the same, like, thing in it. But this one kind of revolves more about, like, it probably has more in common with, say, like, STDs, AIDS, like a thing that gets spread through sex, but it's because of the watching of this movie. So it's kind of an interesting, weird companion piece almost.
Interesting.
But I can't think of what the book's called, but I actually recommend it. It's a really weird and interesting book, and I think it just shows like how talented himself Tobe Hooper was in a lot of different ways.
Yeah. It's driving me nuts, because this entire time I've been trying to remember the name of this story. I guess I don't actually know what they're called these days. A story podcast where it debuted on Shudder, and it's all about this guy, very similar plot, where this guy is tracking down this record that's supposed to have a similar effect, like you listen to it and it drives you insane. I can't for the life of me remember what it's called, but I know it came out through Shudder. But yeah, very, very similar thing. It works really well as a companion piece for this.
I just looked it up. The novel's called Midnight Movie, a novel. So yeah, oh, highly recommend it. I just came across it one day and I'm like, oh, it's by Tobe Hooper. Yeah, so it's another kind of, I mean, it's very different, but it's also got those sort of similar things. So it's definitely well worth checking out as well. So I think that kind of wraps up our cigarette burns discussion. Matt, what would you rate it out of five? Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry, what were you saying?
I was going to say, like, that scene where, before we reveal our ratings, that scene with when Kirby meets the film critic and he's been, like, writing the same review for the film for, like, I think 30 years or so.
Yeah.
That scene really struck home because it takes me at least 30 years to write a review these days.
Yeah, it does. Well,
I actually wrote down the comment in my notes of, I was going to say, who wants to tell that reviewer that no one reads million-page reviews anymore or ever?
and it's pretty...
I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, he's going to be really disappointed once he finally finishes that and realize no one wants to read it.
Like, you could tell, like, because Drew McWeeny, who co-wrote the film, because he's a film critic as well, so you could definitely tell he sort of brought a lot of that into the film. And also, I do love the fact that one little thing that I found really funny is that anytime people talk about any, you know, films in this story, they go by their original titles, like, you know, like they say the Fin Absolute du Monde, rather than saying the English translation, The Absolute End of the World, or even on the cinema where that Kobe owns, Profondo Rosso, which of course is the original title for Deep Red.
So yeah.
People just pronounce that title rather than its English translation, which I found was really cool.
Which is something I prefer to do, but half the time I can't pronounce it. anyway, so yeah. Sorry, yeah, Bede, you got a little bit of editing to do here.
That's all right.
Okay, so I'll start this again. So I think that kind of wraps up our talk on cigarette burns. Matt, what would your rating be out of five?
Really quick before I give it the rating, just quick note, the Shudder thing I was talking about is called Dead Wax. Highly recommend it. And also, yeah, another thing I just wanted to mention really quick about cigarette burns, I just love the film, like you guys have been talking about, is so infused into the movie. Like, there's the guy with that runs the snuff film ring. He actually has that tattoo all over his body that's basically just one long film strip, which I just think is amazing. I don't think I could pull it off, but it's pretty dope.
That performance that guy was creepy as fuck.
He was, actually.
Oh, yeah. Very, very fucking creepy. but yeah, I don't know. Out of five, it definitely walks the line of 4.5. I always have a hard time saying something's perfect, but there really isn't much that I can think of that I don't enjoy about this movie. Honestly, you guys might disagree. The only thing that kind of rubs me a little bit the wrong way with it is just I think Norman Reedus is great, but I don't always believe him in this. Like, he has a lot of great moments. There's just some where I feel like, I don't know, I'm not quite buying what he's selling.
I could see that.
I can see that as well.
I would also say, like, even as a criticism, like the stuff when we see flashbacks with him and his girlfriend, like how they're sort of done up as drug addicts, it just looks more like cosplay than looking like being a believable drug addict.
I think
it's pretty extreme. Yeah,
I think she did. He looked like his hair was too good.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's a good point. He looked like he had done his hair recently.
Yeah. Bede, your rating.
I would give this one about 4.5 out of 5 as well. Like, I sort of appreciated the movie even more so on this rewatch. But I've always liked this one. But this one in particular, I was just really struck by since watching this episode in, 2005 until now, I've seen a lot more sort of horror films since then, particularly Euro horror films. So this one, I could definitely just picked up a lot more of that influence in this one. So it definitely bumped up the rating for me.
I think it helps watching it right after Dear Woman 2 for me.
Look, I think it's pretty predictable. My rating is 5 out of 5. I adore it. I love it. It's just one of my absolute favorites. You know, I love it. It's, for me, it's brilliant. So, yeah. It gets a perfect rating. Even though nothing is perfect, it's close enough.
Close enough.
Yeah, and that wraps up this episode of Podcasters of Horror. Bede, would you like to do the honours of where people can find us on the internet?
Of course. If people would like to find us, let me just find the thing for a second.
Well, you can find us at www.supermarcy.com.
Oh, no.
You can follow me at Twitter at super... Hold on. You can follow me at Twitter at twitter.com/supermarcy. Now, Bede.
Okay. All right. If people want to find us, they can all find our everything super network related. They can find us at our website at supermarcy.com and as well on Facebook at, of course, Marcy. If people would like to find us, they can find our website at supermarcy.com. And if people want to like and check out all of our work, they can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesupernetwork, and also our Facebook private group is also on there as well. So you can find the link for that on the official Super Network Facebook page, and we'll just send us a request and we will let you in into our little awesome little group. And also they can find us on Twitter at twitter.com/SM_network. And if people want to find me personally, they can find me at twitter.com/BeeJamine. Or my Facebook fan page at facebook.com/terribleaussie. And of course, all of my writings and columns are on supermarcy.com. And of course, the latest edition of my column Horror Down Under, which is on the Australian horror film Night of Fear, is now up on thescreencast.com for everyone to read. And of course, if people want to subscribe to our many podcasts, they can find this on iTunes and as well as Spotify, Castbox, and I think I might be missing. What am
Stitcher.
I missing? Oh, Stitcher, yes. They can find our podcasts there.
I think you made a mistake. Our Twitter handle is SM_supernetwork.
Oh, sorry. Apologies.
And
come on, dude.
Mine is twitter.com/supermarcy. But I think we have that covered. And Matt, please pimp yourself out.
All right. Yeah, so you can follow me on Twitter at Killer From Space. I also have a podcast called Killer Horror Critic, which you can find on pretty much anywhere, iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, Stitcher, whatever. It's basically a show where I have a new guest every week from the horror genre on to talk about one of their favorite horror films. I also run a horror review site at killerhorrorcritic.com where me and my writers cover everything in horror, all things horror, so you can definitely check out my writing as well as theirs on there. And other than that, that is it.
Awesome. And we'll be back with another episode of Podcasters of Horror. And coming up on that one will be Fairhaired Child by William Malone and Sick Girl by Lucky McKee. So keep an eye out for that in the near future. And with that, thank you very much for listening. Have a great day. Have a great October. Catch you later.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
All right.
Bye.